Conversations like this are tailored for podcast listeners like you. Learn how you can support them at radioopensource.org. And thanks for being in on it. Thomas Mallon of the wonderful Finale, a novel of the Reagan years. Maybe my favorite new insight in this fine book comes from the president of Iceland, who welcomed Reagan to the famous Reykjavik summit. Vigdis, I won't try her last name.
Finnbogadottir.
Yeah. And in your story, she was thinking afterward, what would she tell her friends about Ronald Reagan? And she could hear herself telling those friends about Ronald Reagan that he might be the most deeply shallow man she had ever met. It would not be a witticism, and she would mean it, she thought, more as a compliment than criticism. Deeply shallow.
Yeah, she never thought this. This is entirely made up. They did have little stroll, yeah, during the Reykjavik summit. But I'm sort of using her, she's a minor character in the book, but I'm sort of using her almost as a mouthpiece for myself, because one of the things that I decided with this book very early on was that I absolutely could not inhabit Reagan from the inside out. I don't know what it says about my character, moral character, but I never felt any difficulty doing that with Richard Nixon in my previous novel, Watergate. But Reagan has defeated many biographers, not so much on the history. There are a number of, you know, lucid biographies that make an assessment one way or the other of the Reagan years, but he defeats them personally because he was extremely unknowable. And I do think that that was more a part of his power than the geniality and the charm. And I think the two things worked in a very, very strange combination and led him to a lot of his success and also to some of his failures.
Of course, I think you're dead on. We've heard this story from Edmund Morris, too, the official biographer who couldn't find the man and had total access for years and had to invent other characters to voice the weirdness of it.
I was a few weeks into this book, and I had written about Morris's book critically in many ways when it came out, but I understood what he was up against once I tried to think about writing Reagan from the inside out. And I fell back on the old Gore Vidal technique here that he uses in Lincoln. He never gets inside Lincoln. You have to get your sense of Lincoln from about six different competing points of view who carry the narrative. And I thought that's got to be the way it is with Reagan. Whereas with Nixon, I didn't have that difficulty. Nixon was all edges. There was always something to grasp onto. And whenever I tried to grasp onto Reagan, I was grasping at smoke.
And you have many more than six, and a lot of them women, made-up characters, but real ones, Pat Buchanan, Pamela Harriman. But here's the point. It resonates with me so because I decided long time ago, and I covered Reagan a bit, that he was really an extraterrestrial. And I say it with respect and a certain affection. He was a man of imagination and spirit, loved to make stuff up. He narrated for me on the plane, campaign plane, in 76, the Chicago Cubs baseball games that he broadcast on WHO in Iowa from a tape that gave only the numbers of what was happening.
Yeah.
All the color, all the
he would
cloud
make
of dust and slide, and the tremendous swing was him.
Right.
And he loved to repeat it. I mean, I think into his old age.
Yeah.
But sort of stick with a certain basis of reality and then go wild was
technique. Show business served Ronald Reagan very well. My editor, Dan Frank, my wonderful editor, when I handed him the manuscript, Dan being a much less vulgar character than I am, I was afraid he was going to cut some of the showbiz stuff in the book. And I said, please don't cut too much of the showbiz reference, because that remained the Reagan's frame of reference. It's very essential. I think I said to him, you know, Gorbachev might have been the chairman of the Soviet Communist Party, but Frank Sinatra was the chairman of the board. And that counted for something with Ronnie and Nancy. And one of the things they used to say about Reagan was that after he had been in politics for a long period, his long governorship and deep into his presidency, when he would have other politicians in the office or foreign leaders, whatever, he never told political war stories about old campaigns and so forth, the way they all do. He always told showbiz stories. And that's what people wanted to hear, too. And that was very much his frame of reference, and I think it shaped his instincts. You mentioned the 76 campaign. After he loses the nomination to Ford, And he's getting up there at the time, it seems, so 65, he'll be too old at 69 to run 4 years from now, but he's still thinking about it. And he gets an offer from CBS News to become the right-wing counterpart of Eric Severide, doing commentaries on the CBS Evening News. And he turns it down, and he says, people get tired of me on TV. He says, I'll keep going in the interim on the radio. And he used to do very short, kind of 1 minute, 2 minute radio commentaries in the morning. I used to hear them the year I was living in Texas. I can still hear them, you know, this is Ronald Reagan. Thanks for listening. And he wrote them himself. He wrote them longhand in a very short form. Reagan was a crisp writer, good sense of proportion, good sense of pacing. The obvious counterargument to that is, well, you know, if you're going to write about ballistic missiles, you're going to need 20 pages. He was, as we know, not a detail man.
Stick with that always reverting to showbiz reflex, because it's in your book and I think it's deep in the story. There's a wonderful moment at the White House, a celebration of George Gershwin. Absolutely classic Nancy production, but Sarah Vaughan singing Our Love Is Here to Stay, you know, The Rockies May Tumble, Gibraltar May Crumble, and all that sort of thing. And Ronnie recalls Hollywood in his early days and a moment when all the studios had a moment of silence on the sudden death of George Gershwin. Mm-hmm. And Ronnie says, I didn't know George Gershwin, but I had a feeling from the intensity of that moment that our paths had crossed. I mean,
yes.
It gives you sort of goosebumps. The point being, one of your made-up characters, Anne McMurray, takes all this in, and she's feeling deep sympathy and empathy with Nancy, but not Ronnie. This man, she says, who might still blow up the Rockies and Gibraltar. Anne had the sense, you write, that no path had really crossed his, that the only way he encountered anyone was by drifting past them on a moving walkway. Again, Hollywood, unreality, it's another woman saying, profoundly superficial, but there's nothing there.
Anne, who, she's a heroine from one of my earlier novels. She was in a book called Dewey Defeats Truman. She's sort of the ingenue in the 1940s. Now she's a grandmother and an anti-nuclear activist, and she's at that White House occasion because she supposedly knows another fictional character who's on the National Security Council. And she's trying to figure out this mystery, also the mystery of these two people together, because as she's thinks when she hears this song, Nancy, who in this book is a kind of raw nerve. I don't think Nancy had 10 relaxed minutes in the White House. She was so fiercely protective. She was always strategizing, always trying to protect Reagan. And Anne thinks about her, you know, this was a woman for whom the Rockies were always crumbling. Gibraltar was always tumbling. And then she, you know, gets on to thinking about Reagan himself. You know, on this business of remoteness, I was very briefly on the phone a couple of weeks ago with George Will, the columnist, and he said to me, I don't know about all this remoteness stuff with Reagan. And I thought, you're not going to like this book. But he says, you know, and I've heard this argument from other people who, unlike myself, knew Ronald Reagan, worked with Ronald Reagan, and they said, no, he was, what you saw was what you get. He was a genial man, warm, courteous. It was quite on the surface. And Will said, it's a very simple story. He had one friend and he married her. And I can see that, but on the other hand, that's not a usual story. Who has one friend? You know what I mean? And who marries their one friend? Even Nixon had Bebe Rebozo, you know, along with Pat. So I do think, just based on my own instincts, I mean, I would certainly defer to George Will in terms of personal knowledge of Reagan, but my instincts tell me that there was something that was ungraspable and that it was a source of his power. In every organization, certainly every White House, any organization, everybody's always trying to figure out the boss. They want to please the boss. They want to gain his favor. I think that that natural process was operating in a kind of exponentially more intense way. And it may have been a source of energy to the whole administration.
Let me compound it a little bit with my own maybe nutty theory. But I think part of the problem in thinking about Ronald Reagan is that he's always been miscast. He was extremism. He was the right wing. He was dangerous. He was a third-rate actor. Ronald Reagan, in my view, was fundamentally a kind of, he played anyway, a lazy cowboy. Mm-hmm. He's not a big hero. He's enjoying life. He's an isolationist fundamentally. He's a peacenik. Never got credit for that. But, you know, he would say things actually like, well, you wouldn't want a nuclear war. That would ruin a whole day in America. the Eastern press especially the Times, has always wanted to picture him as a nut and stupid. In fact, he was understated, but very clear in his body language. And he made peace with the Soviet Union. He ended the Cold War, walked through Red Square, as opposed to the Eastern establishment, which is, after all, Wall Street. It's oil in the Rockefeller family. It's interventionist. It's Henry Kissinger, limited nuclear wars, this kind of stuff, an eternal war that we're still going through. This is not, I believe, the legacy of Ronald Reagan. It's the active pulse of the Eastern so-called moderate Republicans. Mm-hmm. They call themselves moderate. I'm not so sure.
Reagan was very comfortable entertaining ideas that seemed extreme, but he was comfortable entertaining them in a very calm way. And I think that this was helpful to him. I mean, when he is talking with Richard Allen, the man who becomes his national security advisor and is his advisor on foreign policy when he's yet to become president, and Allen asks him at one point, Governor Reagan, he would have said, you know, what's your view of the Cold War? And Reagan probably winked and he said, well, oh, we win, they lose. And I mean, to me, and I have very ambivalent feelings about Ronald Reagan, but there's a lot that I admire about him. And I think that there was something thrilling to dare to formulate things that way and to make that be your fundamental policy. And it was considered preposterous. I mean, a lot of Reagan's opponents, you know, at the time said, look, the Soviet Union's too big to oppose that way. We have to accommodate. We have to get along, whatever. And then, of course, the minute the Soviet Union collapsed, they said, oh, see, they were always too weak to be worrying about anyway. You know, and I don't see how they can have that both ways. But at the same time, as you say, Reagan was the only president in my lifetime seriously to consider or entertain, that's maybe just the right verb, to entertain the possibility of the abolition of nuclear weapons. Not some kind of very tiny drawdown, but I mean, what happens at Reykjavik is really quite breathtaking. Margaret Thatcher comes over to the States a month later to take him to the woodshed, saying, you almost gave away nuclear weapons. Do you realize that if we get rid of nuclear weapons, the Soviets are going to roll over Europe with conventional forces? The most astonishing primary evidence I used in the book when I was reconstructing the summit are the notes that were taken by those in the room when he's negotiating with Gorbachev. And they get to this climactic session where they're really on the verge of getting rid of nuclear weapons within 10 years. And of course, it all falls apart over SDI, Star Wars, Reagan won't give up on. But before that happens, there's no verbatim transcript, but the notes are very dense and it's nearly verbatim at points. And Reagan says to Gorbachev, he uses his first name, makes a point of it, and he says, Mikhail. He goes, 10 years from now, I'll be a very old man. He says, we can come back here, bury the last nuclear weapon, and have a party for the whole world. And Gorbachev is sort of astonished by all this. And he keeps spinning this out. And he says, you'll come up to me and you'll say, Ron, is that really you? And I'll say, yes, Mikhail, it's good to see you. And I realize he's seeing it as a movie. He was seeing, you know, the two of them. You know, this was the fade out of the movie. And there were moments when I think theatricality gave Reagan a lot as president. I think whatever harm it may have done, it gave him more than it took away. I mean, he once said to somebody, I don't see how anybody could be president without having been an actor. You know, when they said, how can an actor become president? And he saw this sort of strange continuum in his life, and he always used to joke with people about Lou Wasserman, his old agent, and he used to say, you know, well, if Lou had done a better job for me, I wouldn't be here. You know, if he'd gotten me better pictures.
Now, this is rich, and it matches another moment in the late 70s. He's out of office, but he's going to run again. The Soviets have taken over Afghanistan, and the Jimmy Carter establishment, including Brzezinski and James Schlesinger and even Henry Kissinger in the sidelines, are saying, you know, we might just have to use nuclear weapons to keep them out of the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And what does Ronnie say? He says, well, we might have to quarantine Cuba. We might have to annex Mexico and their oil. But thank God there's more oil under Alaska than under the whole Persian Gulf. Pure fantasy. Mm-hmm. And Ronald Reagan was deep into fantasy. But the reflex that, no, we're not going to have a nuclear war over this stuff was pure Reagan, and to me, very reassuring at the time.
Yeah. I never felt that Reagan was in any danger of blowing up the world. I just didn't feel that. And the whole cowboy image of him, as you said, he was, what was your adjective before cowboy? Not the lonesome cowboy, but the lazy cowboy. Yeah. Yeah. The loping along cowboy, you know, clippity clop, clippity clop. But he was not the thundering cowboy who was about to draw his six shooter. One of the things that I had to do when I wrote this book, the subtitle of this book is A Novel of the Reagan Years, mm-hmm. and it became in a way much more panoramic than Watergate, which had its own kind of juggernaut of a plot. And it was because the man at the center of it was so ungraspable that I, in some ways, I mean, there's constant talk of Reagan in the book, but a lot of it is a portrait of the time as much as it is a portrait of the man because of this ungraspableness that I really felt. Yeah. And the times were very tumultuous. One of the things that I find very interesting, if you look at Reagan, personally very cautious, a man who could be embarrassed about having been divorced decades after having made this famously close and durable second marriage. He would sometimes say, whenever the Jane Wyman divorce was brought up, he'd say, I'm sure not to Nancy's delight either. Well, you know, she divorced me. And he didn't want to be seen as having, you know, any truck with divorce. He was personally very cautious in his life, but very bold politically, whereas you have this paradox in somebody like Bill Clinton, who follows him several years later, who is famously reckless in personal terms, but as president, was quite cautious. Part Absolutely. Of that was ideology. You know, he was trying to put the Democratic Party back in the center. But the initiatives are small. Successful, you can look at the 90s, and, you know, as Hillary now says on the campaign trail, what didn't you like about the 90s, the peace or the prosperity? You know, she has a point. But in many ways, I think it's hard to look at the Clinton presidency as transformative. It's hard to look at it as a big thing in the way the Reagan presidency was. And the times were so tumultuous. Reagan was very ill-suited to be the president during everything else that is going on. AIDS, homelessness, crack, all of these things. I mean, I was wildly ambivalent about him at the time. I liked a lot of his foreign policy initiatives. On the other hand, my friends were all getting sick in New York. And, you know, I was worried if I was going to get sick. And we were waiting for a kind word from him. We were waiting for him to say the word AIDS, you know. And that's not a bright, serene spot on his record overall. On the other hand, if you're going to do one thing in your presidency and you're going to push the Soviet Union or contribute to pushing them into the dustbin, I think that's a pretty big accomplishment. And I always had the sense that Reagan was tremendously interested in extending human freedom, my freedom included, even though I had bones to pick with him. And I liked the bigness of it all. I liked the daring of it all. Took me a while to warm up to it, but I did.
Make room for the people who would say geniality nonsense. He was a tax cutter. He stripped the government, made it a lot tougher to be poor in America, and an absolute cakewalk for the rich. He was a populist for rich people, but that he ruined the economy.
The only thing I know less about the nuclear weaponry is economics. So, I mean, you'll flatten me. All I know is that, you know, a few years into Reagan's administration, I bought an apartment in New York as a young writer, whereas under Jimmy Carter, mortgage rates were 14%. Mm. You know, whenever I see him hammering those, I mean, I wish him every luck in the world with what he's up against at the moment. But whenever I see him hammering those Habitat for Humanity houses together, I always think, Jimmy, keep hammering. And before, at some point, you'll have built enough houses to give to people who couldn't afford one when you were president because of the mortgage rates.
So what is the Ronald Reagan grip on all of us? I mean, you look at the Air Force One behind the Republican candidates in the Reagan Library. What is the mystique, especially because almost nobody can really identify it?
I think it's the bigness of the president, and it is, in a way, as you say, the mystique. It's the elusiveness of him. He, you know, he's the Republican FDR, and the Democrats, the two presidents that the Democrats always invoked, you know, in my early adult life, were, of course, Roosevelt and Kennedy. They're fading from people's memories now. We're more than 50 years past Kennedy. Reagan will soon fade as well. But, you know, the Reagan administration is still only about 20, 25, 27 years behind us. So he's still fresh. He's still invocable in that way. The way in which they invoke him is sometimes ridiculous. I mean, Trump, of course, you know, would have you believe, you know, we worked together. He thought the world of me, you know, and it is almost absolute nonsense. And whereas Reagan's son, Ron Reagan, whom I think quite a lot of, I think he's a very interesting character, very liberal in his politics, resists the heroic view of his father, but still has a great deal of affection and a certain admiration for a lot of the things his father did. Few of them political, but understood the way the father pursued his own vision. He wrote a very good book about his father after Reagan died called My Father at 100. And it's very affectionate and yet detached at the same time. And he rarely plays that game of, you know, well, what my father would think of this or what my father would say. But I think the other day, I didn't see the whole story, but I saw some headline where the gist of it, I gather, was that he thought his father would be just aghast at Donald Trump. And I agree. One thing Reagan was not was this schoolyard bully. Again, part of the mystery of Reagan, you know, with Alzheimer's patients, one stage that many of them go through is a stage of real rage, frustration. What's happening to me? Anger at the loss of faculties and power, whatever. Even when he was very deep into Alzheimer's, when he would get on an elevator somewhere, they would be taking him somewhere. And if a woman was getting on the elevator in his courtly way, he would get out of the way, hold the door.
Beautiful manners to the end, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And no one ever accused Donald Trump of having manners. So I think he would be appalled at some of this.
Young Ron Reagan, I think, is pretty bold about declaring the anti-imperial impulse in Reagan, or at least the restraint of the imperial impulse. He was not projecting military power everywhere. Brutally, in an ugly way, I always felt, in Central America, in the Contra War. But, you know, they blew up the barracks, the Marine barracks in Beirut, and he said, fellas, we're going home. And he invaded Grenada on the way, just to prove you could take a small island in the Caribbean if you had to. But he was not a world warrior. And I think that's part of, again, the sort of untapped legacy.
Well, I think that, you know, his son has a very good appreciation of these, if you want to call them visionary or just dreamy sides of Reagan. And that, again, with the we win, they lose aspect of him, the other side was the abolitionist, where nuclear weapons were concerned. No politician would talk about that. No politician would seriously entertain that. But Reagan actually thought it could be done in short order. I think the reason history, you know, people say, how did he escape Iran-Contra, which was pretty serious business? Well, one thing he had going for him is he had the advice of the 37th president, who is on the phone to him a lot. That was one of the things that surprised me in my research, the frequency of the contacts between Reagan and Nixon. And they were initiated on both sides. Nixon would send memoranda to the White House, whatever. Reagan would initiate a call to him. They talked during Iran-Contra, and Nixon makes no bones about it. He says, just apologize for the son of a bitch and get it behind you. You know, in other words, please heed the lesson that I, you know, failed to. And Nixon was fascinated with what he thought was Reagan's luckiness. I think he was exasperated probably by Reagan's inattention to detail. But Reagan does survive Iran-Contra. He does apologize. It takes him a while to do it. And then he gets past the thing. And I think that one of the reasons he gets past it, he also has his wife to thank. His wife got rid of Don Regan, his chief of staff, which was a very good thing to do at that point to help save the presidency. But one of the reasons why in history, I don't think Iran-Contra looms very large, whatever iniquities it may have involved, is that the Contra part of it, the fact that profits from the arms sales to Iran, and again, that's the soft Reagan. I want to get those four hostages back. So we'll sell them some arms. I don't really think I'm doing that. And the money, you know, it's basically ransom. And Reagan was extremely upset. They showed him a video of one of the hostages in captivity, and it preyed upon his tenderness. And that sort of led him down the garden path where the Iran part was concerned. As for the Contra part, where the profits from the arms sales were diverted to the Contras, where more serious things legally were happening, I think the reason that history will not pay that much attention to it was, however ill-advised it may have been, however illegal it may have been, it's perceived to have been a poorly chosen skirmish in the great bipolar conflict, ultimately, between Russia and the United States, this proxy war in Central America. And so it was a lost battle, a little fiasco in this larger war that history gives him a good deal of credit for winning.
So who was he, Tom Allen? You bring history and a wonderfully, sometimes mischievous imagination to this guy. What's he all about in the end?
He's still winking at us from somewhere. And I don't think that people are going to get him any more than they really get Lincoln, an utterly different man. And I'm not putting Reagan up on Lincoln's echelon, but I think that the mystery of the personality is something that is finally not really crackable. You know, you can be complicated without being mysterious. That's why Bill Clinton doesn't interest me as a novelist. He's a complicated man, compartmentalized, as we always say, but I don't think he's particularly mysterious. Same thing with somebody like Teddy Roosevelt. All of it comes out. All of it manifests itself in speech and behavior. They're finally knowable. I don't think Reagan really is knowable. You know, as Rumsfeld would say, he's an unknown unknown.
Tom, it's a delightful book. It's deeply delightful. We should have more wonderful novelists telling us about these leaders of ours. Thank you so much for this book. Can't wait for the next one. And thanks for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to be back.
My guest, Thomas Mallon, wrote Finale, a novel of the Reagan years. For many more conversations about arts, ideas, and politics, please visit our website, subscribe to our newsletter, and leave us a comment at radioopensource.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Open Source. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.